council don't mind, we would ask your indulgence just for a few minutes. We have some guests from various colleges and law schools here. And before we proceed, since we're a couple minutes early, we wanted to know if any of the students have any questions of us, sort of in general. We can't talk about specific cases, but if you all have any questions, we'd love to try to answer your questions if you have some. Anything? Okay, there's one question. Can you stand up, please?
Yes, ma'am. How long have you been the Chief Justice here?
About a year, year and a half. I've been on the court 16 years.
So. Did you specialize in civil law or in criminal law? And what is, I guess, more of your interest?
I did a lot of civil litigation, in particular probate, guardianship, real estate and business litigation. That was my background. Justice Holman was a prior trial judge, as was Judge Dofano. Please tell them your experience.
I served on a felony bench for 6 years, and I'm board certified in criminal law. So I like criminal law.
I served as a civil judge in two different courts, first in the 141st here in Tarrant County, and then I had a heart attack, and I laid out for about a year or a year and a half and came back and got elected to the 48th District Court. So I served a total of 5 years as a trial judge, and then I served on this court for 15 years. And I've been retired since 2008.
But we don't let him, you know, sit idle very often. So anytime we need some additional help.
I say, what? You want me? All right, here I come.
Any other questions?
Well, I'll volunteer something. Chief Justice Livingston and I were the first women ever elected to this Court of Appeals in the history of the court. There was a woman who was appointed, but as far as elected, we were elected in, what was it,
94?
Elected in 94, and that was the first time a woman had ever served on this court in the history of Tarrant County or any of our 12 counties, history of this court. And this court was created in 1897, for what it's worth, in case you're ever asked a trivia question about this court.
All right, we'll proceed with our next case, Cook versus State. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the parties.
May it please the court, Ms. Barbara Drumhiller to argue for appellant and Ms. Catherine Luff to argue for the state.
All right, Ms. Drumhiller.
May it please the court. My name is Barbara Drumheller.
Okay, had sentence been pronounced?
Yes, ma'am.
And defendant been placed on probation?
No, ma'am. That's the nature of this case. The original verdict was for probation. After the verdict was returned and read in open court, the jury was discharged in this case. They were released to get their belongings. They were out of the courtroom
That's not my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My question is, had sentence been pronounced in open court?
Oh, I'm sorry. The first time, are you referring
had
to the
defendant been sentenced?
The defendant had been sentenced under the legal verdict. Yes, ma'am.
All right. And this and placed on probation?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
What? Was the trial over?
The trial was over. Sentence was, in fact, they assessed his community service as well. Yes, and the jury was released and instructed that they could, that their term was over.
When a person is placed on community supervision, when do they begin serving their sentence?
When do they begin serving their sentence? As soon as sentence is announced in open court, and as soon as they are sentenced and given the terms of their community supervision.
All right. So in order for another sentence to be assessed, does there have to be a motion for new trial?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And who can file a motion for new trial?
Either side can file a motion for new trial within 30 days. I'm sorry. Only the defendant can file a motion for new trial within 30 days.
So the state cannot file
right,
a motion
that's
for new
correct.
Trial. Can the judge grant a new trial on his own motion?
No, ma'am.
Okay. So what's the vehicle for getting another verdict?
Right, and that's our entire situation in this case. Yes.
Okay.
There are two cases where something similar has happened in this case. They're both obviously distinguishable. There is the West case, which was a 1960 case, where the foreman of the jury accidentally signed both the guilty portion of the verdict form and the not guilty portion of the verdict form. Before the jury left the box, the judge noticed the error and there was no separation. It was immediately corrected, and the Court of Appeals upheld. There was no change in the verdict. The actual original verdict, which was read in court, was upheld, which was for his sentence and the fine that was assessed. Again, that was a situation where there was a mistake in the verdict form, where the jury foreman had signed both blanks. And then the next precedent in the state was the Weber case. That was a 1983 case where, like this one, it was a probation case. In that case, the judge read the verdict in open court and the foreman affirmed the verdict, but the judge, for whatever reason, did not notice or did not read the section of the verdict that contained the probation. So the jury just affirmed the part of the verdict which assessed the time in the penitentiary. And the jury, again, never left the box. The judge, noticing after the verdict had been affirmed that the probation section had also been filled out, said, "Oh, I see that you've also signed the probation," and then pulled the jury on its own motion, the court did. All 12 members of the jury said that, no, the probation part of it was not their verdict. And in that case, again, the Court of Appeals allowed the original verdict for penitentiary only, which the foreman had affirmed, to stand. Again, clearly distinguishable from this case where the judge read in open court the verdict, including the section that gave the appellant probation. It was clear and unambiguous. The foreman responded, "Yes, it is our verdict." No one at that time objected or made any statements to the contrary. There was no request on either side to have the jury polled at that time. And the jury was released. The trial was over. They were instructed that they could speak to anyone they chose. They left the presence of the courtroom, and the judge proceeded with sentencing, assessed the community supervision, and at that point, the trial had ended, and they were no longer a legally constituted jury. When they were called back into the box, the judge said only, "It has come to my attention that some of you have a question about the jury form." It is not reflected in the record how that came to the judge's attention. Clearly, someone must have said something to the judge, must have come from the jury. The jury must have spoken to someone, obviously, in order for that to have happened.
Were there any recitations by the court, recitations of fact, as to the time involved from the time he pronounced sentence to the time he called them back?
The record reflects that it was 4:30 when they were originally discharged, 4:37 when they returned to the courtroom. The judge did not make any particular recitations about that, no.
Okay. So we have no idea where they went.
We have no idea where they went, and that's the point I really want to make, because in the state's brief, they make the statement that the jury hung together and clearly spoke about the verdict form. That's not at all clear from the record. In fact, there's absolutely no information in the record about where the jury went or how this all came about. It's just as reasonable to assume that some of the jurors went to the restroom, some of the jurors were in the hallway at the water fountain. There's just no way to know, and it's absolutely not reflected in the record that they stayed together as a group or that there was no separation.
Is there anything in the record to show that they all returned? I mean, that every juror was accounted for?
Actually, that's not reflected in the record either.
So they didn't have to re-sign anything?
Yes, they did go back and return to deliberate, and they crossed out their probation section while they re-deliberated, yes. Okay. She only polled four of the jurors. That's the other thing that makes this case distinguishable from the Weber case, is that when whatever happened, whatever called it to the judge's attention that there was a question, she reseated the jury. She asked four members of the 12, so one-third of the jury, whether the verdict as read in open court and affirmed by the foreman was indeed the verdict they voted for. And those four jurors, whichever four they were, I mean, there's no way to tell from the record, those four jurors said no. And that was the point at which she reconstituted them, sent them back to the jury room, and said, go back and deliberate some more. Again, the original verdict as read in open court was unambiguous. And the foreman had the opportunity to affirm it, and there was no polling of the jury at that time. Additionally, the jury had sent out a question during deliberations asking about the probation sent out a jury question, and the judge responded with an instruction, please refer to the judge's charge. There was no objection on either side at that time. So even assuming that the state felt there was some kind of confusion among the jury, they had several opportunities prior to discharge to clear that up, first in their own closing arguments, second when the jury note came out, third they could have asked the judge to poll the jury following the announced verdict, and none of those things happened, and the jury was discharged and the defendant was sentenced. I think I'd like to refer this court to what I think is a really well-written opinion having to do with the policies underlying jury secrecy and finality of verdict in the Rosenthal v. Poe case having to do with videotaping jury deliberations. It's cited in my brief. Judge Cochran from the Court of Criminal Appeals wrote a very lengthy concurring opinion in that case, setting forth all the policy reasons why jury secrecy and jury finality is so important. And among those are preventing the tampering with a jury verdict, protecting the jurors from harassment once they've delivered a legal verdict. And again, in this case, we're talking about a legal, enforceable verdict that they announced was perfectly legal and enforceable. Nothing wrong with it, no error, no mistake, no illegality. Finality of judgment is something that runs throughout our laws. You know, once you have a verdict, we rely a lot on finality of jury verdict. Robust freedom of debate in the jury room. If you know that you're going to come back and people are going to question your verdict or there's going to be outside influences or somebody's going to ask you to go back and re-deliberate, that's not something we want to enter into our system. And finally, community trust in a final verdict is a big one, I think, in this case in particular, where you have a verdict in a public trial read aloud and affirmed by the foreman, that should be the end of it. There should be no reason to go back and revisit that. Jurors are not, as you know, under the rules of evidence, are not allowed to impeach their own verdict. They're not allowed to testify about the deliberations or what kinds of things might have happened. We protect the secrecy of our jurors and their deliberations as far as we can. And that's all the way down from the Supreme Court of the United States, and it dates back to the very beginning of our jurisprudence. The finality and the secrecy of jury verdicts, as well as the Code of Criminal Procedure, Article 36.22, entitled Conversing with the Jury. No person shall be permitted to be with the jury while it's deliberating. We don't know what person came to the judge to say that there was some kind of question. Clearly, there was some person who came to the judge. So, you know, at that point, they were no longer deliberating. But then they were allowed to again deliberate. And so, you know, Article 36.22 would be violated if we went back and allowed them to have a second deliberation. That's statutory law.
So if you're correct, what is the remedy you propose?
This court should reinstate the original and the only legal verdict given in this case. That's the remedy that we would request. And with that, I'll yield to my co-counsel or my opposing counsel. If there are no further questions.
All right, thank you. All right, Ms. Love.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Both West and Weber, they're the most recent cases that we have from the Court of Criminal Appeals, published cases that are on point somewhat with this situation. They both stand for the proposition that when it appears that nobody's talked to the jurors about the case, they're still in the court's presence. With both those circumstances, a trial judge can recall them to correct their verdict after a brief separation. Here it's true that the jurors weren't physically in front of the judge for approximately 7 minutes. But fear of taint is the underlying rationale in these cases. And here there's no evidence whatsoever on this record that they were subject to taint. Instead, and counsel takes issue with this, I still say the record supports that the jurors hadn't separated and had only gone as far as the jury room. I say that because shortly after discharging the jury, the court instructed the bailiff to bring them out, then told them to go back to the jury room. They were gone for only 7 minutes. A case I cited, Masters versus Florida, there was no record in that case whether they left the courtroom or how far they went, but they said it was only within minutes, so they still had to be in the vicinity.
Was the defendant sentenced?
Yes, ma'am.
Was there any kind of objection by the defense when the judge called them back in to the courtroom?
Yes, Your Honor, there was.
And do you recall what that objection was?
I have got that objection in front of me.
Is it based on the issue we're discussing today?
There was, Your Honor. I can't find it
okay
at this minute, but I can look it up and find it for you later. And I think, too, surely the trial judge in this circumstance, under these this situation, was the best to determine whether or not there was taint or the opportunity for taint in this case. Appellate points out that the foreman affirmed that the probated verdict was the jury's unanimous verdict, but the record supports that the foreman made a mistake, and the jurors were the ones who brought the mistake to the judge's attention. There were, in fact, four jurors polled at the beginning when they found out that there was a problem. The record does list the jurors' names. At some point, the judge said, do we need to go any further? Because all the jurors were saying, no, that probated verdict is not our verdict. So when they were sent back, they re-came out with the second verdict that was without probation, and then they polled the entire jury, and there are all the names, and you can tell from the record. And I have an extra copy of a few pages if you guys – I meant to attach it to the brief, sorry.
Yeah, you can leave that with our clerk.
Okay, I'll do that. In appellate's brief, she argues that the note the court received from the juries during deliberations supports that the jury was considering probation. I would say that one can infer from that note that the jurors were considering probation on top of jail time. Specifically, they sent out a note that said, can we recommend a specific amount of time in prison plus another amount of time on probation? And also in the brief, appellant complains that the jurors were told that it was okay to discuss the case with others, but that was also the situation in Weber. The trial court in Weber told the jurors that they could go ahead and speak with others.
Who has the burden of showing if the trial was in Weber when the defendant was placed on probation, and who has the burden of showing that the jury did or did not engage in jury misconduct, since if the jury was still lawfully constituted, it would have been jury misconduct to converse with anybody outside the jury about the case.
Actually, I've read some cases in other jurisdictions similarly on this point. They go both ways. Some of them say it was not the defendant's burden. Some say it was. Okay. And unless there are any more questions, I'll conclude.
When does a defendant who's placed on probation start serving the sentence? Do you agree when he's placed on probation?
Yes, Your Honor.
And once the defendant starts serving a sentence, isn't the law pretty well established that you've got to file a motion for new trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Left. Ms. Drumheller, rebuttal.
May it please the court. Again, the jury in this case did leave the box, unlike in the Weber case. That's a huge distinction. In the Weber case, the jurors never left the jury box. So despite the trial court's instructions to them about being released and being able to speak to other parties, there's no question that the jury in Weber had no opportunity to speak to other parties. As opposing counsel just said, in this case, we know that they at least spoke to the bailiff. We also know that they were told that they could talk about the merits of the case with outside parties. We also know, unlike opposing counsel said, that the record reflects that the jurors called it to the judge's attention. In fact, that's not true. That's not in the record. It's not clear who called it to the judge's attention. The judge merely says, it has been brought to my attention that some of you have some questions about the jury form. As far as the note goes, I would maintain that it doesn't make any difference what the note indicates about whether they were considering probation altogether or probation on top of a pen sentence. The fact is that they sent out a note asking for instruction, and they received that instruction. There were no objections to that instruction that they received back. They had the court's charge. They had all the information that they were legally entitled to, and they made a decision for probation, which was very unambiguously and clearly read out. The foreman had to sign a separate blank saying, yes, he has not been convicted of a felony in this or any other state, and we additionally believe that his sentence should be probated. So whatever happened between the jurors in the jury room is not for us to consider, as jury deliberations are meant to be secret and not meant to be inquired into. And the trial counsel, in fact, did object when the jury was brought into the box and requested a mistrial on the basis that she was trying to allow them a second shot at deliberation. When I said that no one knows who these jurors were, I didn't mean their actual names. We can tell, obviously, from the record which specific jurors were polled, the four that said it wasn't their verdict. I meant that in the context of jury deliberations, you don't know whether those four particular individuals agreed to a verdict, voted on a verdict, and then regretted it. I mean, it's impossible to say why those particular four individuals felt that it wasn't their verdict. Regardless, the record is clear that at the time that the foreman affirmed the verdict and the verdict was read in open court, none of those four jurors spoke up or said, wait a minute, that's not what we agreed to, we didn't vote for that, and again, apparently didn't even make any kind of a fuss that would tip off the state to ask for a jury poll. So, you know, whatever their thoughts after the trial is over and the defendant is sentenced is not material to the trial. The trial was over at that point. Again, we would just ask that this court reinstate the only legal verdict rendered by the jury and reinstate appellant's probation. Thank you.
Oh. Does criminal law have JNOV, a judgment notwithstanding the verdict?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Drumheller. Ms. Left, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is now submitted and you are excused. We will now adjourn court.